joining us now on the Press Pass, KPLT 1490 AM, 96.3 FM. We have arbitrator Michael Green, who's also a law professor at Texas A&M University School of Law. Michael, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
All right, and what we want to talk about basically is, of course, this Ezekiel Elliott trial, all the hearings, everything that he's going through, and he's going to be back in a courtroom coming up on Thursday. Tell us a little bit about what this particular hearing is going to be.
Well, sure. This is a hearing for the Second Circuit Federal Court of Appeals, and what has happened at this stage is he has appealed a decision by the district court judge with last week, where she had decided to deny his motion for an injunction. So he had basically asked the lower level trial court to enjoin the NFL from implementing its suspension. That judge decided that that was not a proper action, denied his motion for an injunction, but allowed him to immediately appeal to the higher court, which is the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit then decided that they needed time and wanted to have a hearing, so they then did allow a stay, which allowed him to again play this last week. This hearing on Thursday will be focused on whether or not they should overturn the decision of the judge denying his motion for an injunction.
So would this be pretty much the final straw if it goes against Zeke? If he rules on Thursday, or if the judge rules on Thursday against Ezekiel Elliott, that's it, that's said, that's done, and he'll serve his six games?
Well, one would think that might be the case, but I think the problem you see in terms of how all of this has kind of gone back and forth, again, that's only the challenge to whether or not the courts could rule that the NFL cannot suspend him until the merits of his case are resolved. He still has claims as to the underlying merits as to whether the commissioner's decision should be upheld. This is just about whether or not they can stop the NFL from implementing the suspension. So let's say he loses in front of court on Thursday, based upon whatever decision they make. That just means that the NFL can go forward with the suspension. Now, he could even try and challenge that, I guess, if he wanted to. You could try and get in front of the Supreme Court. But he can also try and, you know, deal with the merits. Now, the problem is, and the real argument here about giving an injunction, usually you have to show that there would be some irreparable harm that would occur. And the lower court judge said there's no irreparable harm here. So if the Second Circuit agrees, then, yes, the NFL could go forward and try and implement the suspension. Now, he could still challenge the underlying decision to have decided to suspend him in the first place. And the question would be, if he eventually won on that, what would that mean? What would be his remedy if he's already served a six-week suspension and you later find out that that wasn't the appropriate decision by the commissioner? So I think there could still be more litigation coming forward. The practical effect, though, is if the NFL is no longer enjoined from implementing the suspension, the pragmatic effect might be that, yes, that could be the end of it.
All right, there you go. So irreparable harm is something we've kind of been focused on here, because it seems like that is what is surrounded in this case. That's the focal point of Zeke's defense. However, it seems almost subjective, like it's not something that is proven, that is a hard case. like an opinion, it seems like, as to whether or not the judge thinks so or not, because you have several judges who have said, yeah, this would cause irreparable harm, and then this judge out of the Southern District of New York says, no, that not be the case, along with several other different takes on this case. So how does that play in as far as how it is determined whether or not it's irreparable harm or not to Zeke?
Well, I think so really there's two issues, right? So the first issue, so what first started is you have the commissioner's decision with him acting as the arbitrator, and they went into court even before the final arbitrator's decision was issued and tried to stop it. They said that the process was unfair, that that Commissioner Goodell didn't get the input from one of the main investigators who had maybe recommended that they not take disciplinary action. There's also questions about being able to question the primary witness against Zeke in the case. Those are kind of process issues that were raised to challenge the underlying decision. One court did say that, a Texas court did say that was improper, but then that went up to the Fifth Circuit, which is the court that oversees the Texas courts, and they rejected that, and that led to filing in the New York area in the Second Circuit, and this question of at least getting an injunction preventing the NFL from even implementing the suspension until the merits are resolved. To get an injunction is where the question of irreparable harm comes up. An injunction is kind of an unusual type of thing. Usually you let the parties fight it out and let the courts eventually resolve the merits. An injunction says, well, you can't implement this disciplinary action until the merits are resolved. That's unusual, and you have to show irreparable harm. Now, the standard for irreparable harm, I mean, it may seem kind of doubtful or factual or unclear, but generally you're saying that this is an unusual thing to do, so another component of it is likelihood of success on the merits. So the judges have to believe that this injunction is necessary because he will be irreparably harmed. And one argument to that is, as we said, if the consequence is that by implementing the suspension, there really is no good remedy he will have if you later decide the commissioner was wrong, that might be irreparable harm. So irreparable harm is really involved with the injunction. The underlying issue was the process fair that was used to decide he should be suspended in the first place.
Now, there's been a couple of things that are really interesting to me that I've seen, whether it's just a couple of lawyers that I follow on Twitter to try to keep up with this case. One of those is the notion that the NFLPA is being, you know, so deep into Zeke's corner and you know, just, I got your back, man, we're going to do everything we can. But that is more so to help themselves when the new collective bargaining agreement window opens up rather than actually helping Zeke. Some feel that he's fighting a losing battle to begin with.
I think there's a lot of support for that notion, because if you think about the underlying merits, at least, you know, and you can go back to what happened in the Tom Brady decision eventually. If you think about the underlying merits, usually courts do not get into the merits of an arbitration decision. The general thinking is that the parties entered into an agreement. They decided on who would make the decision and how that decision would be made. And all the courts are trying to do is decide, did they agree to let this party decide it this way? And once you do that, the courts stay out of the merits. So in that aspect, yes, it is kind of an uphill fight for Zeke on all of this. Now, the NFLPA certainly may want to support its members, and they certainly may have a broader objective that these issues may give them some traction at the bargaining table when they initially want to deal with this article that gives the commissioner so much power as a decision maker to kind of bring this to the table with public sentiment and their support regarding it.
And so it's all going to come back to whether or not the NFL has followed through with the rules of its own collective bargaining agreement. But speaking of that, I wonder, and this is something I've wanted to ask, is the judge in New York that ruled against Zeke, it turns out that that judge is married to a lawyer who practiced with the firm that wrote the collective bargaining agreement with the NFL. Is there anything to that in terms of a conflict of interest, or is it just something for people to talk about and it doesn't really matter in the case?
I mean, this first thing I've heard of that, but I think most of the time federal judges, certainly they have relationships, things of that nature with other folks, and they tend to, you know, have ethical requirements and in terms of their decision making process, and I wouldn't even suggest that there would be any reason other than it sounds, you know, it's an interesting topic to raise, but I feel from looking at the decision, I looked at Judge Feller's decision, and seemed to be based upon basic notions of how labor law works, and consistent with what the Tom Brady decision was.
All right, and that's the last part that I want to talk about, is every other judge prior to getting to Judge Feller in the Southern District of New York said that this is different from the Tom Brady case, that this isn't the same thing, it's not along the same lines. Is there something, and what I've seen as well is people saying this is a case that is going to be talked about in the law classrooms, that is going to be discussed because it's such a unique case. What makes it unique, and is it something that law students are going to be looking at and shown in the classroom?
Well, I think as a law professor who covers labor law and labor arbitration, at least at this stage, I haven't really seen anything unique about it in terms of how labor law gets addressed. It's certainly, you know, a popular topic. Dallas Cowboys players, the media and all of that has brought on kind of a lot of public interest. And I certainly think that was the case with the Tom Brady decision as well. I think this ultimately goes to collective bargaining, though. And so the issue is the union, the NFL Players Association, has agreed to these terms that give the commissioner such broad power. And the real question is, do they use their bargaining power and go to the bargaining table to try and change that power? Now, the courts that have gotten involved in this, yes, there have been a lot of kind of lower courts, you know, the first level of the court that have gotten involved in this, and the general argument that the union has made, and their attorneys have been quite successful, at least initially, in making these arguments, is that some of the processes the commissioner has used have been fundamentally unfair. And that's the argument that has gone forward. It happened in the Brady case in terms of maybe not allowing him to question certain people, the general counsel that was involved in the Ezekiel Elliott case, the question of Goodell making a decision without really getting the input of the person who actually interviewed the main witness and had recommended that they not pursue any suspension. Those are all process issues, but in traditional labor law, most of the time when the decision is finally made, the courts stay out of the merits. Why this has resonated, why these kind of cases have resonated so much, at least with those first level of the courts, is kind of an interesting issue. But from a labor law perspective, most of the time, at least we've seen so far, when they finally get to the appeals level, the underlying cases do tend to be rejected.
So what it sounds like to me, and then I'll let you go, is basically the judge, as far as a labor arbitration standpoint goes, would ultimately look at Zeke and say, hey, look, your players union signed on the dotted line. You're basically at the mercy of this man, Roger Goodell.
I guess you could look at that. There's Article 46 in the collective bargaining agreement that gives the commissioner broad power. And even the last time when there was open negotiations for collective bargaining agreement, many thought the Players Association would really push to limit the commissioner's power, but you know they didn't do that. They got some other things. They got some concessions regarding safety issues for the players, but they didn't try and limit the commissioner's power. Now, the next time the negotiations occur, maybe these kind of cases have occurred. Part of the problem, though, is for the union is the lifespan of an NFL player's career is very short, so their bargaining power can be limited sometimes because they may not want to hold fast on these issues for long periods of time if it's going to affect the amount of time that they can play as a player. Also, these discipline issues, they're probably thinking, how often is this going to come up? This is going to be for players who have real disciplinary problems. But now you've seen it with two high profile players like Tom Brady and Ezekiel Elliott, where it may become more of an issue for the players union to address in the future.
There you go. Michael Green, labor arbitrator, also law professor at the Texas A&M University School of Law. Thanks for helping on with us, man. Thanks for explaining and then laying this all out for us.
My pleasure.
When we return, we'll talk with Coach Aaron Emmy Abbey from the North Lamar Panthers getting ready for the Crosstown Showdown. That's next.